everybody. Welcome to the Brain Trust Podcast. My name is Adam Vass, and I'm a tabletop game designer in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
My name is Leops. I'm a tabletop game designer in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Adam, what's up?
Not a lot. What about you?
We're in those dog days of summer right now, aren't we?
They're ending, but they never really end.
Yeah, I feel like I'm going to take some of the summer with me for the rest of my life.
The Campfire Kickstarter ends this week. Braintrust.rocks, if you haven't checked it out already.
It's going awesomely. Get in there. Get those special editions while they last, because they won't after the campaign, and there's some cool shit in there, including a tote bag, a flexi disc record of the Camp Keeper, and a theme song. There's a air freshener that smells like a campfire.
Yeah, there's a some stickers, a patch, just like a swag bundle. Oh, the challenge cards.
And yeah, there are challenge cards, which are like optional elements to make your game more challenging and like a genre direction. So one might encourage you to incorporate a final girl into your story or the alien or something. Those are bad examples.
We're off to a strong start, as is typical.
I've been an affinity designer all morning, redesigning the Torque board, picking up from last week.
That does not sound fun.
No, it is really hard to design a game board.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. Big props and respect to board game designers, people who illustrate game boards and stuff. But even just from a pure graphic design standpoint, it is so hard to get what I want on there.
Yeah, because it's like a lot of things, it's an aesthetic thing and an information delivery device. And those two things want to fight each other pretty often.
Yeah.
It's hard. I mean, I think one of my better successes with that is the Cobwebs play space.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, I like could see it in my mind before I made it. It was fully realized. There's like a Greek god who was born out of someone's brain. You know that one?
Yeah, it's Willie Obst.
Yeah. It was
Greek god from brain. Let's see. Coeus.
Classic Coeus.
That's
Everybody
Coeus.
Knows the tale of Coeus.
Titan of the inquisitive mind.
It was Trolls 2 that I was thinking of. Baby Diamond comes out of the Diamond Troll's head.
They're eating her.
In a Coeus-esque
manifestation. And then they're gonna eat me. Who is the most intelligent Greek god? Who would you say?
I mean, I think there's got to be one that's probably, like, the god of thought or whatever. The god of brains.
That's Abacus.
Yeah, they have a distinct advantage in this competition.
Being smart.
It's like, who's the god of partying? It's Dionysus, right? No one can out-party them because they are the god of that thing. Like, you can't say who's... Although, if you exclude the one, if you say, who's the smartest god except for the god of smarts, then you have
something going on.
Because,
good. Second best.
You're always going to have... The number one is going to be the ruler of that dominion, and they're the ruler for a reason. So you're always looking at the number two spot. Who's the second smartest Greek god?
Are you smarter than a Greek god? Anyway, yeah, you are like as we all know, you are much like Coeus, the Titan that was, you know, his name means query or questioning. I'm questioning. And so wow, this is cool. Okay, there's also Metis, who is associated with wisdom.
Mm.
So are you an inquisitive mind, or are you wise?
Inquisitive. For sure.
Let's see what this fool looks like.
What if it's just a picture of Baby Diamond from Trolls 2 World Tour?
Wow, you said Trolls 2, and I thought you were talking about Troll 2, and yeah. I made a Troll 2 joke.
Oh, that's why I realized I had to add the World Tour part to make it clear what movie I was talking about.
I want to watch Trolls 2 again. Or Troll 2.
World Tour.
Koei just looks like a dude. Nothing cool. Nothing interesting. This is troublingly...
Speaking of nothing cool, nothing interesting. we're 6 minutes into the show. What are we going to talk... You have anything you want to do today?
I want to hang. I want to chill. I've been playing a lot of Resident Evil games. So I'd be interested in talking about, like, a campaign horror kind of game.
Yeah, all right.
But wait, let's talk about playmats a little bit more.
Yeah. I mean, so the Cobwebs one I think is great. Cobwebs is a game that has great illustrations, thanks to Sally Cantarino. But a lot of it sort of exists. Like, so since it's a conspiracy game, you can kind of pull that off by just having black and white, like, clean text, making it look like government documents or whatever. It just redacts shit. And, like, you're still being thematic without needing additional illustrations or a ton of graphic design. And yeah, that's a real benefit for that project. Because I'm also staring at one of the playmats from Final Judgment, which was a card game I released a few years ago, that I use as a mouse pad now because it is a mouse pad. It's from custommousepads.net or some shit.
We get it any way we get it.
And all it is card outlines, like 2.5 by 3.5 inch lines where the cards go, and then some paintings underneath. And this one, it's different. I mean, it's a strategy game, so there's already some dissonance there, because in role-playing, I think about this with Guide, think about this with Campfire, is how much... what's the core function of the play space? And with Torque, it is an information-heavy thing. I would say its primary function is relaying and tracking information. I think Cobweb's playmat is there for generative function for the most part, because it's die dropping and the space that the dice land in is the most important thing, although there is also a tracking element. Guide has, I would say, very little information delivery and more about organization of that information.
Yeah.
And Campfire is probably the most aesthetic purpose of all of these. But that's not to devalue it. Like, it's an immersive quality to the game. And in terms of information, there's almost none explicitly on the play space. I think we've made an interesting, like, spectrum here of X and Y is, like, how much information is, or I guess the x-axis is how much information does the playmat give you versus you using it to maintain the information that you generate. And then the y-axis is how much does it look really cool and feel immersive and important to the quality of your storytelling.
Yeah, and it doesn't directly, it's not linear in that, like, the more information you need to present, the less cool it can look. Because right. Cobwebs, just as you said, is a great example of, like, you are conveying a lot about the game and the playing of the game on the mat, with also having it be really thematically strong and good. So where I'm at with Torque is, like, starting from the starting line. To use a little racing metaphor, I like to call the starting line is where you begin. But to make it look as fast as possible, like, to communicate movement with, like, things rushing around, but also trying to keep it really minimal, And so I'm just really, because there's not a lot to go on as far as like previous game design. I don't know how many playmats are for like a gestural tactic speed related thing. So I'm pulling from like pictures of like F1 circuits and like racing lines and things like that, just to figure out how to get this like the perfect angle of momentum to make it feel like the things that are in the first row are zooming along, the things in the back row are lagging behind.
Yeah, that's an interesting, even just like in presentation, how does something feel? How do you create movement? How do you create the feeling of speed?
Is difficult. Like the first board was nice and like stylish, but it didn't have any of the speed that I wanted, where you could walk by someone playing Torque and be like, oh fuck yeah, they're going fast. I don't know what they're doing, how fast exactly. I don't know the nature of the speed, but I know that they're going. So
graphic design speed parallel is italicizing things, tilting things.
Yeah.
Create some of that drag.
Getting tilty.
And I haven't seen the Torque board in a while, but that angular quality was definitely part of it that led it. It pushes it to the right, which in America is forward, effectively.
I'll share a really kind of basic one with you right now that I'm just blocking shit out at this point to like get. It's so hard to fucking design these boards because you can't just like say, hey, design my game board for me. You have to like do it and block it out, and there's so much work. And then you have to test it. You have to test the fucking shit out of it.
What way are you sending it to me?
I'm gonna text it to you.
I feel like we're currently on a Skype call, and we often will switch AB, iMessage, and Discord text message. There's no shortage of ways, but then I just won't see that. Here we go. Oh, this is cool.
Yeah, so you can see I've put in this like graduated curve that everything's going on, and like just kind of blocking out the spaces of where things should go and how textury to get. And I don't know, I just whipped out the guide playmat and just was looking at the bitmap like halftone stuff that you did on it, and like the kind of grittiness of the florons and everything. I'm just like, how do I get that grit everywhere? And I honestly think it will be with using one less color. Like right now there are only three colors, and I think I could do this with just two colors.
Yeah. Well, black and white and yellow, or are you counting the sort of tannish color as another one?
Oh, yeah, black and white and yellow.
Yeah. So a thing that I might recommend checking out that is probably outside of the reference that you currently have is look at motion graphics. Ben Marriott has a YouTube channel that's my favorite motion graphics tutorial person. But a lot of motion graphics talk about how to make things feel natural. You give the illusion of speed or the illusion of like these biological qualities to effectively just shapes or text or whatever. It's mostly an advertising and animation thing, but the way that things compress and expand to emulate that feeling that it is moving in a natural way, that like you might find some interesting hacks. I think too, animation in general, there has a lot of this with like smears and giving the illusion of speed by playing with how your mind perceives the frames that they're giving you.
Yeah.
Especially like old school traditional hand drawn stuff. Do you know what smears are?
Yeah, I'm where it's a little slinky.
Yeah, so if a character is throwing a baseball in the first frame, you see them holding it. And in, say, the fourth frame, you see the ball, like, being released from their fingertips. In 2 and 3, you might see their arm warp into ways that are not biologically sound. But when you see all the frames in a row, it makes visual sense that there's, like, power and movement there. So it's like filling in the gaps that your brain's already trying to fill in. So sometimes an animator will throw like 4 arms in a single frame. That's when you see somebody, you know, who falls off the cliff and then looks down before they fall.
Yeah, sure.
When their arms are waving, there's usually 3 or 4 pairs of arms flapping around, and your brain registers that as this frenetic movement. Because if it was just a single pair of arms doing the same thing, it would either be going so fast that it's not necessarily valuable information to you, or it would be going so slow that it doesn't convey the frenzy in the action. So that's all to say, you did this too in the last one. The NASCAR logo does this of having shapes repeat, but the shapes change some quality, whether it's line weight, whether it's angle, and your brain kind of registers that as movement and speed. There's a lot of tricks to stuff like that that can be conveyed visually in a, because I'm also thinking of playing like Formula D or something, like a racing car game, and how static and boring the board is because it's just a racetrack. But there's no implication of movement on it. The racetrack is static because the players are moving the cars. And I would say that's like a failing of the same kind of conceptual thing you're going for.
Right. Yeah. The whole thing is like, I want the, it's a 3x3 grid, and each tile is the size of a 3x5 note card. And so it simulates a pack of cars moving down a road. And so the road is the thing that's moving, the pack staying kind of static, and it's your relationship to this pack. So, yeah, exactly. Like, how do you keep it slinky and slurry while still having this kind of static relationship between the places?
Yeah.
It's hard.
Yeah, it's not easy.
I'm glad I'm taking the time to do it, but damn.
Yeah, I think I'm glad to be stepping away from it and not necessarily. I don't think I'm working on anything else that has board or like tangible space involved. Because as much as I do love it, it is hard. And doing more than one of them at the same time, I feel like, is especially hard. Trying to do, like, I imagine even for you, the spatial awareness that Torque has is so much different than that the Campfire has.
Right.
And it's not the same as, like, all of us who are working on 12 works in progress can shift between them. But this having a visual quality, almost, or at least to me, makes it a lot harder to shift between, because I'm not just, like, soft resetting. I'm having to, like, hard reset the way I'm thinking into a different visual space and tonal space.
Absolutely. That has been like a huge source of frustration too, where it's like, it does feel like I have to get into a different mindset to just graphically engage with this project. And so like, that's what I've been doing the last 2 weeks, not writing, just assembling like pages and blocking out character sheets, because it has to all inform each other. Like it can't. The other thing about a playmat is it also has to rhyme with your rule book and your marketing collateral and your logo and your character sheets. And it's just another thing. Like, RPGs already kind of have a tenuous relationship to their own character sheets, I find. Like, some games have character sheets that don't really fit with the theme of their game, and some that extremely do. And those that extremely do usually take a magnitude more of work to get there.
Yeah, that's an interesting... I think that's a much more common execution of what we're talking about here, that I kind of didn't consider is similar mindset of balancing aesthetic and information delivery and information tracking and like all the qualities that you want effectively a play guide or anything that you're using in play besides just the rule book to have some, at least one or maybe more of these qualities. I think my success on the character sheet front is the Necronautilus one. It's just a skull.
Oh, big cool fucking skull.
It's a cool fucking skull, and you write the things that you need in the eye sockets. There's some information tracking in the nose socket. There's some space at the bottom for more kind of like note-taking tracking stuff that you can do. But it's very in your face about what this is. And I think that's pretty excellent. I've tried to capture that magic sense, and it's definitely not easy. With Necronautilus, I started with the skull, and then I figured out what information needed to go in it.
Right, yeah.
And that's a rare treat. I mean, that game really spoke to me and told me what it needed often, and I kind of let it happen, and that's really graceful, but that's a perfect storm, you know. Since then, really, I feel like every project I've done has really been kind of banging my head against the wall.
Sometimes you just muscle it. Like, that initial spark is always there, and it doesn't always go to the end. It would be ridiculous if it always did.
Yeah.
I think, like, you kind of get away from intentionality if that's the only way you make stuff.
Right.
Like, sometimes it's struggling against something. Like, that's why I'm redesigning this whole fucking board. Like, because it was okay, but wasn't perfect. And, you know, I had these other things. Like, I want people to be able to play with a Matchbox car. And so how do I make that possible? And how do I make it so the print and play kit at home is functional while still having a full-size board? Like, yeah, I think when embarking on bigger projects like this, just having a folder of like design specimens or even like a design Bible kind of thing for visual and thematic stuff,
yeah,
will just pays for itself. Like in that time you spend making it.
That reminds me of a game that I never, back when I was into strategy stuff, I was working on a turf war warriors kind of gang game. And I definitely have a Pinterest board of like cool 70s gang shit that I should dig up and use that for something. But Pinterest is that's how I do this, is because it's an engine that feeds itself, you know, like if you put three things in it, it starts to be like, what have you seen this thing? And you can usually kind of go down that rabbit hole, which is fun. It's great for type and layout specimens. But I think especially for, I have a Finsta that I use for cyber metal to basically collect fashion stuff without ruining my own Instagram feed. So I can follow like weird, I don't understand the world at all. I'm a total tourist, but
yeah, same.
You know, people who are like wearing like tactical fashion. Like they have a sword and a gun, but they're still like just so swaggy.
Yeah.
That's what I'm going for.
I feel the same way, like with the Big Grave, assembling stuff for Big Grave, my fashion fantasy game, where it's like, I know what is really cool to me. I'm like, as you say, I'm a tourist here, so I'm just going to have my mind blown every time. I fully sacrificed my own personal Instagram account to finding cool artists and fashion accounts. Yeah, I'm really not going to use it for fucking anything else anymore.
I get that for sure.
Yeah, sure. Welcome back to the Brain Trust Podcast. I feel like I should reintroduce myself. I'm Will. And this is Adam. Go back the campfire Kickstarter.
What are you doing?
What? You're just sitting here listening to this. By the time this comes out, there are 2 days left.
I'm low-key thinking of announcing Cyber Metal at the finish line.
That's hardcore. I think you should give yourself some time, but
just announcing. I don't have to do anything except for say, oh, like,
that's true.
Here's the next one. Y'all enjoy this one. Y'all enjoy the theory of this before you, whether or not you know that you will enjoy the real deal.
Why not some other amorphous concept? we sell concepts as game designers.
And that's what Kickstarter is, and I don't think I don't think it's a bad thing. But Cyber Metal is a game that does well on its concept. In the way that Necronautilus did, is like you might have questions about particular qualities of it, but you kind of know on the pitch if it's your thing or not. And I think that's great. I like doing that. I like not necessarily overthinking. It's easy to market and just be like, hey, if this isn't your bag, that's fine. If it is your bag, let's go. I'll figure out the rest later.
I think you and I are good at titling games so that they do that work for you.
Yeah, totally.
Like, you know if Campfire's for you. You know if Torque is going to work for you.
The cover, the logotype, the name itself are as important on a crowdfunding campaign. And arguably forever, not just funding.
To
get somebody interested in your thing or not. And
don't judge a book by its cover, but do judge a project by its logo type.
I mean, even at the bare minimum, you can tell how much someone put into it already. Like, with Necronautilus, with Cyber Metal, they have these custom, like, extremely custom logo types that show, even if the game's not done, I'm putting in the work, and the work that I'm putting in is novel, right? Like, not everyone can make this, and I am making it. So, like, if you like this much of it, you're probably going to like the rest of it.
Yeah, it's like a pH test for your project.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, I'm just taking a quick sample to see how much does this logo whip.
I've definitely been tricked by this in the past, getting a book that on its cover is really cool and doesn't deliver for me, because that cover, that logo type, that name sets an expectation. But I mean, that's the nature of the beast too. That is judging a book by its cover. I'm asking you to judge my books by their cover, and because I think that will get you to buy them. Because I know I did a good job on the cover. I know I'm going to do a pretty good job in the middle, too. But, like, you won't see that for a minute, and that's okay.
I like working on the insides a lot. Yeah, and that's not to say, like, you need to be a great typographer like Adam to do a project. Like, just pairing the right type and the right colors is enough.
Mm-hmm. There's a science and an art to it. There's rules, and then there's ways to break those rules, and there's advice, and sometimes doing the opposite of the advice is going to get you a unique thing. It's just alchemy of having a good thing come out.
Yeah, like, sometimes it's enough just to schmack some words in your name on a pretty picture, and other times you can just use words or just textures, or there's so many things you can do to make something unique and your own.
I was just going through a lot of my zines in preparation for the Grand Rapids Zine Fest, which is coming up in the beginning of August, and noticed how per project I'll sort of offer me challenges in that way of, like, so Veneration, my St. Anger RPG,
right,
has only text-based art except for one spread that has some monsters in it at the end. And the cover, which has no text on it, which was also a fun experiment. But I think to some extent that was by design for trying to get it done on time, was like, let's not draw every single page. But also it becomes its own really unique presentation of just hierarchical text within the rules, and the text is flavorful because it's the lyrics to Saint Anger. So it does a lot of heavy lifting, and it's hand lettered, but it is in like a fracture style calligraphy. So it's conveying information in that way that good type can, while also just being an aesthetic value of the book. And then I look at something like the frequency, which I planned out because I wanted to see how a risograph printer would handle replicating the style of painting that I do. So all the art in that is hand painted in black and white and replicated through risograph. And that is another interesting, like, I think this is game jam kind of theory, but just the idea that the constraints breed creativity. Having a book that's only text, or having a book that you only use images instead of subheaders, or any kind of like challenge you can give yourself in that way, is going to come up with a pretty unique visual presentation, even unique from the rest of your work. I think that's cool, exciting stuff.
That's a great point. I really like that as a challenge, and it will also make your visual design just really, really strong, because you're stretching something to see how far it can go with what you need.
Yeah, yeah. I think I also focused a lot on it, obviously, in the physical presentation of the book, but I've also seen people doing the same sort of theory stuff really well digitally, and that's exciting.
Yeah, I think designers, like both visual designers and game designers, like Chris Bissett, are really good. Like they're in particular really good at seeing how physically far you can stretch public domain art from 200 years ago.
Right.
And like getting like a maximalist approach out of that and making it feel really fresh and contemporary, just with like post-processing techniques and just really good curation.
Yeah. Gontijo is also expert at this.
You did this for a guide as well, yeah.
Yeah. It's another one of those things where it's an imperfect science. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, and it's just a matter of trying. I think in guide we pulled it off really well, but I also acknowledge it's not my go-to. I love seeing other people do it, but I have a lot of difficulty making my head wrap around it of someone saying, here are your tools, now you have to make something out of it. Those are not my usual tools. I find that really difficult to get out of my normal kind of understanding of what I do. But I would say the same thing about the actual game design or writing. If you're someone who makes GM-less story games and someone says, can you make an adventure game, like that's you understand it, you have the skill set, but it might not be your number one outlet, and you might catch some snags. But then in that same way, you're going to bring a unique perspective and a unique new kind of approach to something that's being done by other people too.
Yeah, and I know you and I are both like this, where we don't want to design the same game twice, and we'll take each project as an opportunity to just either learn or flex a different part of our design muscles. It's like a Iron Man competition. But like, you know, I'm looking at games down the line that like have hit points, which I haven't made a game with hit points yet, or like use a GM, or, you know, whatever, things like this. Like Torque is a challenge to see how you can do tactical and story gameplay with no GM. And what does that look like?
My Cyber Metal is combining like trad challenge based dice rolling stuff with narrative what the fuck, somebody's ringing my doorbell. I gotta see what it's like.
That's classic shit, go for it. What was it?
The person who rang the doorbell is with the pest control company, and they're here to refill the bait traps for mice. But they emailed me yesterday, and they've said you don't have to be home. They said all this stuff like it's basically a no. I don't need to do anything. They're just going to go outside the perimeter of the house and fill these traps. There's no interaction necessary. So I don't know why they rang the doorbell to just wave at me and say, I'm here to fill the traps, because I knew that. And to access the doorbell, they had to climb a literal pile of concrete rubble where my porch used to be. And there's two guys still dismantling the porch with tools. And they're all just standing there like, what the fuck? Like, nobody needs to be here right now.
I think they just want to make sure you're not going to open fire on anybody in the backyard.
Yeah, your home looks like it's literally under attack, and I need to make sure that when I go put mouse poison around, that I'm safe.
I don't want to see a red dot sight on my chest when I look up from the mouse trap.
You just, oops, I think I just turned video on. Ignore this.
Oh, hey. Beard's looking good.
Oh, thanks. I cut my hair today, so my beard looks longer.
Nice.
I was just trying to put my phone in my pocket, and I touched a button. Whoa. This is the most distracted I've been in a podcast, maybe ever. Which is interesting, because yeah. So many distracting things happen over the course of the brain trust. And today feels specifically fucked up.
Maybe we should kind of center ourselves, or just really shoot the shit. Either way, we should make a decision. Are we going to fully devolve for the next 20 minutes into kind of a loosey-goosey conversation? Or are we going to talk? We talked a lot about important shit before, so I think we've kind of earned a chill out.
Sure, let's do it. I don't care. I mean, I think that sounds good. That's Have you had the mystery flavor Sour Patch Kids?
I had it literally yesterday as a Slurpee, but it was from... Yeah, yeah. The mystery, it wasn't flavor? A Slurpee, though. It was called like a Froster or something.
Oh, yeah.
Everything in Canada is a little bit... a little bit fizzy. So like Froster instead of Slurpee, Looney instead of $1. But yeah, it was very hot yesterday, and Seb and I got Frosters, aka Slurpees, and I can tell you what the flavor is because Seb is a super taster and they figured it out.
I figured it out through a not fun way, which was because they have clues. They're giving you clues. And I figured I followed the clue trail.
Seb is informing me that Canada does have Slurpees, but they're pronounced Slurpois. I am 1 week away from vacation.
I'm never going on vacation.
No, Adam!
today I stopped by the Vault, the comics and games, the Vault of Midnight in Grand Rapids, Michigan, comics, games, and toys and more. Ooh, I got a couple Sucklord toys. I was pretty happy about getting those.
Sucklord.
And I was saying like, yeah, I think I'm going to, or I did some work to get Cyber Metal Kickstarter page ready, get the preview page and get some likes and buzz going. And I was like, this is going to be my August project that ships in December. I'm finishing my June project that's going to ship in October. I have Fiskborg that's going to ship in August. I just don't see a future where I can take a break.
You can take a week off in any one of those months.
Truthfully, you're right, but it's a weird mental hurdle. Of especially scheduling far out. I'm not good at scheduling far out for a lot of reasons. Quarantine made me very aware that I can't predict where my head is going to be on any given time. Right. So even the idea that we're recording tomorrow. What the fuck? Today, it's today. We're recording on a Monday. I just scheduled a playtest of Draw Down the Moon for tomorrow night, and even 24 hours in advance, I'm like, oh, I better build myself an off ramp here.
Yeah.
I actually have shit every day this week. And then and it's Monday, and it feels like too much already. And a lot of them are like chat on FaceTime with someone I haven't seen in 2 years for 20 minutes. Like, it's not even a strenuous
task.
That can be big.
Not to discount that. I mean, not to be your boss, but you're going to be better at your job the more breaks you take.
Yeah, I think my breaks... I do a lot of mini breaks, micro breaks.
That doesn't count.
Right. Today I went to the post office. I dropped off 100 orders. I worked for maybe 2 hours on Cyber Metal. And then I came home to play video games. Because the video games... And then tonight I'm playing Masks. What's the subtitle of Matt? The Next Generation or something? That's Degrassi.
Son of the Mask.
I'm playing the superhero game that everybody likes. So the video game, playing video games for 2 hours was like me rewarding myself, but it's not.
That doesn't work long term. Like, you get 8 hours for work, 8 hours for yourself, and 8 hours to sleep.
Right.
A day.
I definitely don't work for 8 hours. I haven't in a minute.
That eight hours of work number isn't 8 hours of constant production. Mm. But that's like when you're thinking about work, sitting at your computer, etc., doing that stuff.
I would argue that playing Watch Dogs is part of work. Because I'm a game designer, but because that game's not fun. Holy shit. Did you know that it isn't fun?
Wreck-em.
They made a video game that's not fun to play.
Ubisoft made a video game that's not so much fun. What's not fun about it?
I genuinely don't even understand. I wonder how many hours I've put in to find this out. There's no fucking point. It's just... And that's fine if it's like meant as a sandbox thing, but like it's a sandbox where you don't have enough to do things that are interesting.
Mm.
So the game loop is... And so the conceit of the game is you can play any character that you meet. So you can see someone on the street, walk up to them and be like, yo, what's up? You want to join this Freedom Fighters group, terrorist organization?
Want to be my Antifa super soldier?
And they're like, yeah, I'll join, but you got to do something for me first. And then they give you a mission, and you have to go do the mission. And once you do the mission, then they're on your team. So then you can be them. And go up to a different person on the sidewalk and say, hey, what up? You want to join our Freedom Fighter group? And they go, yeah, but I need you to do something for me. That's the loop. And there is a main story, but it's so vapid and like deeply Ubisoft that it doesn't compel me in any way. And it's just not a fun game. I did get it on deep sale. I think I got it for like $9. So...
Oh, nice.
I feel vindicated in that way. But wow, it's not fun. And it's like a near future cyberpunk. It's probably like 5 years off. So there's drones everywhere. You can hack a drone and like fly it around. There's self-driving cars, but it's otherwise very much like today. And for whatever reason, I think that's a massive failing of the game. I think it has no real imagination to it and nothing really special about it. It's just a lot of grinding, a lot of stealth, and I really hate stealth video games.
You should dump that game.
Yeah, I should.
in the past like 3 weeks, I have beat 3.5 Resident Evil games.
Oh yeah, we were going to talk about Resident Evil. I can see the soundbar of a guy taking a hammer to a concrete block outside.
That's this episode and us.
Yeah, I wish someone would. I wish someone would do that to me.
Just disguise your head as a concrete block, or just get in one of the rat traps. Resident Evil 7, great. Resident Evil 8, great. Resident Evil 2 Remake, great. Resident Evil 3 Remake, great. Zombies are back, everybody. I had a dream about Tony Soprano killing a zombie.
It's good. It's very good stuff. Tone. Hey, Tone.
I started watching The Sopranos. This is now just us catching up.
That's fine. Who cares? We deserve this. We earned it.
We're running a Kickstarter. That's probably why we're so fucked right now.
I mean, it's definitely part of it. I gotta be honest. Feel like I haven't given it my full attention. But don't know what else to do with it.
Yeah, this has been a set it and forget it one. I mean, when you're not running stretch goals, you just ride.
Yeah, I think that's a good thing. Our basic strategy at this point is tweet at least once a day and, you know, kind of write it out. This is the end, so I'll probably send a newsletter, one of my rarities this week, a MailChimp. I mean, it's like we were talking about a minute ago. You know you like it or you won't. So what am I going
to
do?
I can't say more stuff to get you to like it.
I don't like the idea that I should say more stuff to get someone to like it. This is a...
I mean, that's the problem with stretch goals, is that you're just trying to find a larger audience to activate the customer base that might not exist. And so, like, we're not interested in making the most giant game possible. We're interested in picking the perfect apple. And so we've already done that. Do you want a bite?
The other thing is I really don't want to convince someone that they want something that they might not want. And that's what sales is and marketing. But, like, I think that's why it is so important to me to be upfront with the promise of the game in its presentation and say, you know, Necronautilus, you're going to be a soul in a stone or metal world. And that's it. And you're going to do missions for death. There's more than that if you want, kind of, but like, let's go or don't. I'm driving a bus and the bus route has been mapped. This is
yeah.
This is not like a freestyle. Get on or get off, and I don't care what you do. But if you're on, I'm gonna take you to the good times.
We will sing songs on the bus.
I think that's good. I mean. It's something I've been...
That's kind of where it's where we were at during Zine Quest, where we were feeling a lot of... I don't know what the emotion was, but we were just looking at the top projects of Zine Quest and being like, people aren't coming to Zine Quest for, like, original games. And so how do we make every time we come to Kickstarter be worthwhile and sustainable for us to do it? Because it is... absolute parasite. It is a worm inside my body trying to kill me, eating all the food that I eat a little bit. How do we make every time we go on there worth it for us and not the stress nightmare? And so one of those things was like, as few stretch goals as you can get. Like, that's key.
Yeah, I think the other is just knowing what it is about your project that you care about. And I think stretch goals does focus that. And not, you know, not leaving those decisions up to your audience or your ability to grow your audience or any kind of, like, unknown. It's just that it's fine. Yeah, Ether Operations was my Zine Quest thing. And it funded, and I was like, okay, cool. Everything else is gravy. Fiskborg was this a little bit, although I'm still kind of in the thick of the work for that. I just love a good gravy project, you know?
That's why we're doing this. We keep on putting up shots.
and they're good. It's good to learn from. It's good to you learn about your audience. You learn about the things that you care about and prioritize, both as a publisher and as a designer, because you're relaying that information to an audience. But you're also, like, yeah, just staying true to yourself, I guess. That's a big aspect of it to me.
Yeah, same.
Necronautilus wasn't finished when it kickstarted. Spoiler, I guess. Like, here's a little secret. Not all games are done on day one, because that's fucking ridiculous to ask of people.
Remember I was talking about the board redesign?
Right.
An hour ago?
Because there is the perception that Kickstarter is a pre-order system. I don't remember why I started it.
Being true to yourself.
And, like, through the campaign, I realized, like, oh, I should focus a little more on ship stuff and travel because it's space. No one said that to me. It's just a realization I had, and I'm glad that I did. It is an important part of that game. But the game, despite the design still being in flux, I knew what I wanted it to be.
Mm-hmm.
That project had stretch goals too, but they were sort of like phony.
Right. I mean, like with Campfire, I don't know why we're not like regretting making Campfire or anything, but just like to conceptualize it with stretch goals is like each additional author, stretch goal deck author, that would be a stretch goal. So like you get your banana deck, you'd get your Linda deck, whatever. And we're like, we're not interested in making a game that doesn't have these people involved. So why even let it to chance?
Totally.
We're just not interested in doing that.
I think, too, there's the weirdness of, like, people who do this. I don't want to knock anybody who's doing it. But the idea that, like, if we had my deck as a stretch goal and we didn't hit it, and then we're in publishing and we go, well, we didn't unlock it during the campaign, but we're doing it anyway, because it was
right
cooked in and we were going to do it the whole time and the whole thing is an illusion.
We just didn't get the money that we said, like, the whole thing is don't plan stretch goals before your campaign, for after your campaign starting. Like, your most sober self will make up a campaign that is good and not scope creeping, and the closer you get, the more you waver from that initial thing. And so, yeah, it's there's a lot of psychology for, like, do you do stretch goals? Are stretch goals things that make your ultimate perfect product, or does it make extraneous stuff, or what? And so we are in the boat of making projects their most complete version as you buy them on Kickstarter, as you back them, and not something that comes from the process of Kickstarter. I think we both, on a different level, want to divest Kickstarter's effect on our own creative practices as much as possible, because ultimately it is a leech on our, like, on our business and on our artistic practice, but we have to use it. So as much as we do, like, I don't know, there's probably some psychological level for me where it's like, I don't want a Kickstarter to make something possible that I could do. I just want the Kickstarter to put it in front of as many people as possible.
Yeah.
And to give me the money to make the thing I could already make.
Totally. And as I'm setting up the Cyber Metal one, I'm realizing too that I'll just give a 10% discount. That's my Kickstarter approach. Thank you for helping me realize my project that I want to make and am likely going to make no matter what. But for being an early adopter and for kind of going in with a less of a complete understanding of what both of us are doing here, I'll chuck you a little deal.
And making that known on the Kickstarter page would be great. Just saying, like, the whole Kickstarter is an early bird discount.
Right. Because it is effectively pre-order. I treat it like my Patreon. It's going to happen. People who miss out are going to pay a little bit more for the exact same product. But I just need the seed money so that I'm not taking the risk myself. And everything beyond that is just cool. I'm just happy with whatever.
That's the motto of the Brain Trust podcast. We're happy with whatever. And it's been another episode, and wow, what a winding road we've been on today.
Every day is a winding road.
Every day is a gift. That is a walk on the winding road of life. And I'm Will. You can find me online at will.com. On Twitter, Will_Yobst. I got a newsletter. Good Luck Press got big things cooking up, including Seb Pines' Dwelling Kickstarter that's coming to Kickstarter on July 6th. That'll be fucking awesome. We'll talk more about that later. Go pre-save that. Where can people find you?
My games are at worldchamp.io, and I'm on Twitter at WCGameCo. And Cyber Metal 2012 is coming this year, maybe, probably. The game is good. I need the money for it now, please.
We're so tired.
Yeah. Yeah.
I gunned a Monster Energy during this episode, spent, and like I utilized all of the energy, and now I'm fully depleted.
I'm on two coffees a day now. That's a rare one for me. I'm usually a one-er. One and done-er.
I'm two minimum. Two minimum.
So, I'm depleted. The Sour Patch Kid mystery flavor is banana cream pie.
It's not pina colada?
No. Although, no, it's banana cream pie. But I wonder if Canada banana has a different one. Banana cream pie.
Yeah, we have a different one.
Also, if the Slurpee one might not be the same as the bag one.
Yeah, the process strips all the pineapple out of it, turning the slush into the kind of firm gelatin boy that is a Sour Patch.
Gonna go ahead and say I'm not interested in a creamy sour candy. The banana cream pie is not my favorite flavor. I also thought it was bubblegum for a minute, but the clues pointed me to the BCB.
What are these clues that we're talking about, Mr. Police?
I've got a bag on my on my desk. It gives laughs and can be a riot, because when it flies, nobody's silent.
What is that last stanza about?
I think it's just a
nobody's silent.
It might be struggling to do a rhyme. Just like, oh shit.
Nobody's silent.
No one.
You have all the clues. So what is it? The answer is actually injustice.
This would fuck up my game of I don't even remember what the hell I named this game. The one where you eat Sour Patch Kids and talk about a movie that you make up. It doesn't account for the mystery. I gotta write a damn expansion for the banana cream pie.
Damn it. More content. We should say goodbye.
Bye.